Let me quickly introduce Susan and then give her also the opportunity to give more details and also her personal perspective on her trajectory through the different sciences. So Susan has a bachelor's degree, holds a bachelor's degree in psychology from the Barnard College of Columbia University, and her master's of science she received from the University of Pittsburgh, where she also received her PhD from, also in psychology. And I was just focusing in my introduction, I will focus on two or three things where I think Susan will not focus at. So, she's currently a professor and co-director at the Learning Sciences Research Institute at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Let me also mention that she had been the president of the International Society of the Learning Sciences, with a quite strong positive impact in the direction of having a more stringent and more elaborate organization of that scientific community. She was part of many very well-known initiatives and large research projects, including Cognition and Technology Group at Vanderbilt and the Jasper Woodbury series Anchored Instruction. She is also currently active in several editorial boards, and also she's an associate editor of the Journal of Education Psychology. She's in the editorial board of the Journal of the Learning Sciences, and in the editorial board also of Education Psychologist. She received quite some awards, quite a number of awards, and I picked one where I thought, I'm not an expert in that, but where I thought this is maybe one of the most visible. She's among other things, she's a fellow of the American Educational Research Association. And now, Susan, we are looking forward to maybe a couple of more words to introducing your own biography or your perspective on your biography, and then, of course, on hearing your presentation and interacting with you on cognition and metacognition.
Well, great. I wanted to give a little bit of background in terms of how my own thinking about learning and the factors that impact learning evolved. When I was a PhD student at the University of Pittsburgh, I was at the Learning Research and Development Center. And so from the very beginning of my education, I had one foot in psychology and I had one foot in educational issues. And that organization was trying to ask questions about how does what we find out about the psychology of learning as we do the work in our quote unquote laboratory settings, how does that make any contact at all with what happens out in the world where people are doing school or doing other at the time it was really focused on schools. It's obviously gotten much broader now. It was I was brought up with a very much in the head perspective on thinking and cognition. I had very strong background in psycholinguistics and took a variety of linguistics courses. And although I was trained as an experimental cognitive psychologist, my interest in language and psycholinguistics really exposed me to a broader set of disciplines than if I had been interested in something other than language as a PhD student. So I started to also get exposed to some of the philosophical perspectives, such as the Lakoff's perspectives on meaning and case grammar analysis, which was also popular at the time. You got to realize I'm very old. So this was like in the 70s, when cognition and being able to sort of talk about the mind and actually do research to figure out how the mind worked was really in its infancy in the United States. But I'll get into that a little bit later. In any event, it was an exciting time because people were really excited about trying to figure out how people thought instead of looking just at how they reacted to stimuli that were presented to them. Anyway, I had the good fortune there of interacting a lot with, of course, my advisor, Chuck Perfetti, who is now directing LRDC, as well as people like Bob Glaser, who was a pioneer in the field of instructional science or instructional psychology. He argued that you needed a bridging science between psychology and education in order to, I think at the time he used the word translate, I think now we would use the word adapt or look at how things that are learned in one setting travel into another setting and what happens there. But in any event, he was a major influence on my life as well. I also got an opportunity to interact with Lauren Resnick and Jim Greenough and Mickey Chi, who was a postdoc at the time, and Jim Pellegrino, who, as you probably all know, is a master right now of assessment and what's going on with efforts to look at both classroom-based and formative assessment as well as large-scale summative assessment. So all those things impact my thinking. As I moved into my first job, which was in a psych department, I only stayed there a year and then moved to a job at the University of California, Santa Barbara campus, where I was actually in an educational psychology program within the School of Education. I maintained an appointment in the psych department at Santa Barbara, but it was sort of a courtesy appointment, although I did get to teach a course or two there on a regular basis. And I interacted with people like Rich Mayer and Mary Hegarty, as well as people in the educational psychology area. The impact of that work was that I started to really think about schools, because I worked with some people who were working in special ed at the time when California was giving, well, when Apple was giving a computer to every school. All they had to do was apply, and we did some early work in looking at those computers. Whoops, hold on a second. Okay, I have a timer on my thing, and if I don't use a key or something, it goes to sleep. In any event, that's where I started to learn about the fact that you could give people things and they might sit in the closet, or they might use them as doorstops, or they might actually have kids use the computer. We did a lot of work on that and how to more effectively use computers with special education students as well as with regular education students. From Santa Barbara in 1989, I moved to Vanderbilt, where I had an opportunity to work with John Bransford, Ted Hasselbring, and later Dan Schwartz, in a very exciting time at the Learning Technology Center. We developed anchored instruction as a concept and embodied it in the Jasper Woodbury Mathematical Problem Solving Series, which got quite a bit of notoriety. And then in a program that didn't get as much notoriety at all was a Scientists in Action series that we actually filmed, but never really had the impact that the Jasper Woodbury series had. While I was at Vanderbilt, again, I was exposed to this field, this world of education and cognition, and trying to bring the two into some kind of discourse and alignment. At the time, that's when I was vice president of Division C of AERA, which is cognition and instruction as it is now. But on the board, I also got exposed to the people who were doing the history of education, who did Division G, social context of education, Division K, teachers and teacher education. And my view of what was involved in learning and what one had to really think hard about started to really expand as I started to learn how these people looked at education and what their frames were and how they thought about what the issues of education were. And at the time, in the early 90s, Journal of Learning Sciences was being formed. John Bransford and I went to that infamous meeting that Roger Schank held at Northwestern, in which he just summarily renamed artificial intelligence in education into learning sciences, and he called it the International Conference on Learning Sciences, and created quite an uproar that in the community, in the international community, that in many ways we're still trying to repair. But anyway, he was sort of one of the primary instigators of a learning sciences approach, which brought together computer science, many disciplines, computer science, psychology, anthropology, philosophy, linguistics, to try and deal with issues of how do we design learning environments that create contexts in which people can learn, both in the workplace and in school contexts. Of course, Roger is probably most infamous for his statements in public about how we just needed to blow up the schools. But I never subscribed to that view. And eventually, Roger went on to do his entrepreneur thing, and learning sciences went in a different direction. But I was part of the group that tried to help organize learning sciences as a society. And I can't remember exactly the year, but it was sometime in the probably late 90s that the International Society for Learning Sciences was formed. And at the time, I was also heavily involved in the Society for Text and Discourse, which had formed a community around how people understand both conversation and printed text, traditional text. And so I took a sort of member role in ISLS, but not much more. And then in the late 90s, early 2000s, my interest in learning sciences expanded. I moved here to UIC in 2001, and we really tried to pull a group together around issues of learning and ultimately became the Learning Sciences Research Institute program, which is about 2007, 2008. No, it was around 2010 that I was elected to the board of ISLS. And then I think I started to be president in 2012. In any event, I'm still on the board and continue to expand my work with teachers and kids who are existing in classrooms. I've also gotten into some informal learning environments, working with people at the Brookfield Zoo, for example, and had some conversations with the Adler Planetarium, and looking now at both places of formal education as well as informal education. I have, for the past 4.5 years, been running a very large project called READI, READI, Reading, Reasoning, and Argumentation in Disciplinary Instruction. And we're attempting to look at how the literacy practices of disciplines intersect with content learning and understanding the fundamental epistemology and core ideas in history, in science, and in the interpretation of literature. So I've had my plate quite full. There's about 40 of us working on this project, distributed over four institutions. And so I have gotten very much into how to design learning environments with teachers, using iterative design-based research to test them out and keep track of what's happening. We've been building educative materials for teachers, as well as then studying how they're enacted and how what impact they have on kids. So a lot of attention to the work samples and how one assesses students' learning looking at work samples, as well as more formalized assessments that are designed to tap the learning objectives that we have instantiated in this work. So when I was asked to do cognition and metacognition, I felt like, well, that isn't quite the best fit, but that's okay. I'll do it and see where it goes. So the way I tried to structure today's meeting is to give you some of the historical background on where metacognition came from. And as you probably now realize, it came out of developmental literature. So those of you with developmental interests should feel right at home. And where it is now, I mean, and because it's gotten both broader and narrower. And it's gotten hooked into what became a sort of track all its own called self-regulated learning. And as people start to talk more about motivation, about interest, about curiosity, about self-efficacy and confidence, all these things become sort of intertwined, and their connection to metacognition, I think, is really quite fundamental. So the second piece I gave you, which is a 2013 piece, attempts to really show how self-regulated learning and metacognition and cognition kind of fit together. So you have like where it started and the reasons it got started, the questions people were interested in, and then, you know, now many years later, I haven't done the math, but isn't it like 40 years later, how people are thinking about it. And what I really wanted you to do, and I hope you guys have taken some time to do it, it was the sort of special assignment other than reading for today, is to really do some thinking about how metacognition plays out in your work, where it might have an impact, why it's important, rather than me sort of talking and telling why I think it might be important in early math or in early science and in argumentation. I hoped that you guys would do some thinking about that first and we could have some conversations about it. Now, it looks like everybody but the LMU group are by themselves. Just nod your heads if that's correct. I'm not seeing any movement, but I'm assuming that that is the case. Okay, so one of the questions that people have put in the chat box already is the distinction between cognition and metacognition. And I think the Griffin piece is really pretty good on that, and we'll get to that as we talk. So stop for a second and see if anybody has any questions or wants to make any comments right there.
So just Susan, if you want to if you want us to discuss or to come up with the prepared ideas, I think it would be good if we could ask the LMU to just switch off their audio for some time, and then we could have the rest of the group discussing here, so that the LMU group could discuss locally and the rest of the group could discuss here, and then we have a plenary after 5 minutes. That would be a way how that might work, if you think.
Okay, we can do that. That sounds like a good plan, Frank. I think that what I want to do is first go through some of the slides, and then there's a natural point. I think it's like slide 9 or something, where I wanted to have that discussion. So let me walk through a little bit of this, and then we can, I'll stop for questions, and then we can keep going. So I had you read, I'll just get started with the first slide then, in which I talk about metacognition, its origins. John Flavel was a developmental psychologist. He was actually one of the main person who brought Piaget to the United States. He translated Piaget into English. And that was a major breakthrough, because then, as now, people in the United States tend to be English speakers, and they tend not to ever become fluent in any other language unless they absolutely have to. Not something we're proud of, but it is a fact of life. So unlike you guys, who have managed to learn at least 2 languages and sometimes 3 and 4, we are pretty singularly English. And so stuff in other languages was pretty much out of our reach. And so his translation of Piaget into English had a major impact on American developmental psychology. But at the time that he did this, it really fit in with the cognitive revolution in American psychology, that it actually begun in the early 60s with George Miller and others who became interested in looking inside the head. So on the second slide, which I titled First There Was Cognition, because I wanted to just discuss a little bit about why the 60s and George Miller and others and sort of the origins of information processing was so revolutionary in the United States. I think it was not so revolutionary in Europe, because I don't think the behaviorist psychology that dominated American psychology ever took over quite so powerfully in Europe, and specifically in Germany. But for the better part of 1900 to 1960, American psychology was dominated by SR, or behaviorist psychology, back when John Watson started this movement through Skinner and Skinner's others who developed SR theory. It was quite interesting, because what they were trying to do was understand there's a stimulus out there and there's a response on the other end. And the fact that it went through your head didn't matter. What they were trying to do was determine the stimulus conditions that produce particular kinds of responses. And the thought was that this was the same for everybody, more or less. There wasn't any real effort to ask how an individual's history, how they're processing, that language did not exist in psychology until George Miller and others introduced psychology to information processing kinds of notions. And that was very much in the head, but it started a examination of what was going on inside that black box. And people began to, there were data coming out of some of the behaviorist labs and traditions that had contributed to giving more weight to a paradigm shift to the black box being important. Basically, the data were becoming just overwhelming, that all people did not respond in the same way to the quote unquote same stimulus. And so people started saying we need to better understand how people perceive those stimuli and then act on them. How do they filter what that leads to people reading different things into quote unquote the same external stimuli and then responding differently? So the question was why, and how does this work? So people began to ask questions about how people actually processed the information, and that gave rise to this information processing tradition that really took a powerful hold over American psychology from around 1962, early 60s, to somewhere in the mid 70s, when some of these other ideas from developmental psychology and some of the research in a strict information processing perspective started to yield some puzzling phenomenon. In the mid 70s, I'm on the next slide now, the idea was that was added to the notion of looking at thinking was the idea that one could think about their thinking. It was kind of in the air, it was infectious in a way. There were two developmental traditions that contributed to this sort of sense that we really needed to look at people's thoughts about their thinking, as well as look at their thinking. And that's how I distinguish metacognition from cognition. Cognition is the thinking you do. Metacognition is the thinking about that thinking. It's also the thinking about your knowledge, the things you know about how your brain works, how your mind works, how your knowledge systems work. I'll get into that later. So it was in the air for a couple of reasons. In addition to the growing interest in Piaget, there was also a growing interest in Vygotsky's notions of self-regulation. Vygotsky, a Soviet developmental psychologist, was very heavily influenced American developmental psychology and instructional psychology, with the notion that you learn through interactions with more knowledgeable others. And this learning is re undergoes regulation, and initially it's done by these more, the regulation is done outside the self. It's done by these more knowledgeable others. Ultimately, the individual comes to regulate their own cognition. And that notion of self-regulation got hooked into being able to think about your thinking. For Piaget, Piaget was much more in the head than was Vygotsky, as we all know. But one of the four cornerstones of Piaget's theory was that interacting with others and your social interactions and the experiences you have interacting with others was very important to your development, to the cognitive structures that developed. He believed that interacting with peers makes you aware that others don't necessarily think the way you do, which produces thinking about thinking, according to Piaget. So we have these two developmental psychologists coming from different perspectives about the mechanisms of learning, still talking about the need to think about your thinking. Now, the meta part of cognition had its start with memory, because at the time in the 70s, most major developmental psychologists like Flavel and his student John Wellman, and like Anne Brown, were in fact studying memory, children's memory. So if you go to the next slide, I have a few comments there about metamemory. So the meta part of metacognition began with looking at memory. Flavel gave talks about the idea about metamemory. He published a chapter in 1976. And then he published the paper in the American Psychologist that you read. Now, at the time, the American Psychologist had very wide distribution. It still does. So that paper is written for a generalist audience of psychology people, developmental as well as non-developmental. At the time, as I said, much of the work on going on with children was memory research. Flavel had a doctoral student named Marianne Kreutzer, and she published in 1975 her dissertation, which was basically a series of interviews, sort of like trial, with K through fifth grade children, that's like 5 to 10 year old children, to find out what they knew about their memory system and how their memories worked. It's quite an interesting monograph, which I actually read because I was a graduate student at the time. And you know, you read the most things you ever read when you're a graduate student. Anyway, I read it. It was fascinating to find out how kids talked about their thinking about their mind, with the younger kids having much less understanding of how their minds worked than the older students, and being much less able to monitor and regulate what they were doing to learn things. So one of the phenomenon that people discovered was that kids would overestimate how well they had memorized a list of words, because that was the stimuli they were learning. And so if you said to them, "Are you ready to tell me the words that were on the list?" they'd say yes after one trial and of seeing the words once. And of course, they couldn't remember most of them. But that as you got older, you were better able to judge how much more rehearsal you needed of those words before you were ready to actually recall them. Now, around the same time that Flavel was doing his work, Anne Brown, I'm on the next slide, was looking at the accuracy of self-assessment. And self-assessment, your readiness to be tested on something. She had a chapter called Knowing When, Where, and How to Remember that was published in 1978, in which she talked about this work. So this is like now, between 73 and 80, you have a lot more talk about metacognition as well as cognition. And then in 83, in the Handbook of Child Psychology on Cognitive Development, Brown and Bransford, a student of Brown's named Roberta Ferrara and Joe Campione, published a chapter that had a lot of impact on the field. Called Learning, Remembering, and Understanding, in which they, reported data, but also speculated about what a number, the results of a number of studies taken together really meant for the kinds of questions we needed to be asking about cognition and memory processes separately from knowledge about one's own cognition. And memory processes, and that there were different kinds of questions that we needed to investigate, but that we needed to investigate both. Brown went on to extend her theorizing about metacognition to comprehension work. She published a paper in a volume in 1980 that Rand Spiro and I think it was Dick Anderson published, that introduced the concept of metacognition into the comprehension world by talking about metacomprehension, your knowledge of how you are comprehending what you are reading, and your knowledge of strategies that you have to comprehend. And she and Linda Baker published a paper in 1984 about metacomprehension that is still a very widely published paper. I'm sorry, a widely read paper. Actually, I'm not sure it's widely read. It's widely cited. I hope it's widely read, but it is widely cited. So to kind of come back now to this whole issue about what is metacognition and how is it different from cognition. There's two aspects of metacognition, knowledge about cognition and about how you think. And then there's the regulation of that cognition. So the monitoring functions, as well as the knowledge of your knowledge of how your thinking systems or your memory system or your comprehension system works. So you know that you do certain things when you don't understand something. Maybe you go ask for help. Maybe you reread. Maybe you get out a dictionary. Maybe you go to Wikipedia these days. Who knows? Maybe you go to online help for understanding. But you know that you have those options, and you know that when you don't understand something, and you also know when you don't understand something. And that's more the monitoring part. So you have to recognize that you don't understand something special about that. And if you don't ever check whether you understand or not, you're never going to do anything special. And so you're likely to understand some parts and not understand other parts. I'm going to stop, well, in 1 second. Okay, so the paper from 2013 kind of tells you where the field has moved to. And as I said earlier, there's much more emphasis on self-regulated learning. There's a great interest, I'm on the next slide now. There's a great interest in the independence of learners and the ability to assess their state of knowledge. There's interest in the relationship between beliefs about knowledge and learning and cognitive as well as metacognitive strategies exhibited. So Ivor Broughton and Helge Strömsö and to some degree Rainer Broma and Mark Statler have been looking a lot at metacognition and how that metacognition and epistemic cognition, metacognition about, they've both been looking at multiple source comprehension and what the Norwegian group has done in a number of studies is looked at how people think about knowledge in the domain that they're reading in. So if you're reading about environmental science or climate change, what's your understanding of how knowledge is created and what's important about knowledge in that domain. The more you know about that and the more sophisticated your understanding is of the epistemology, the more likely you are to deeply process multiple texts and attempt to integrate them and evaluate and critique them and then integrate them. Rainer Broma and Mark Statler have been looking into aids for metacognition while you're reading multiple sources. So this relationship between what you know about knowledge in the domain and how it's constructed impacts how you process information. That relationship was first established by Ivar Bratton and Helgi Stromsa, and I think it connects into this aspect of metacognition, which is knowledge about the part that's knowledge about cognition as opposed to the monitoring part of it. So there's a lot of ways that people think about the relationships between beliefs about knowledge and learning and the cognitive as well as metacognitive strategies exhibited. Now, the 2013 paper by Griffin has a diagram that depicts some of these relationships. What I'd like you to do at this point, I've reprinted the diagram on the slide, slide 9. There's a question that's posed on this slide. What does this figure help you see or understand? I'd like you to take, say 5 to 8 minutes to look at it yourself and jot down what you think this figure shows, or what you take from this figure about all these things that are in boxes and labels and their arrows and dashed lines and so on. Take a few minutes to unpack this figure, and then we'll talk. So I'm going to stop broadcasting and come back on in about 6 minutes. Are people ready? You could just indicate if you need more time in the chat window. Okay, so it looks like people are ready. So I'm not going to do the work for you guys, so please get in the queue. And I'm going to stop broadcasting in a second, and let's hear what some of your thoughts are about what this figure is trying to say.
I also had some thoughts, but I wanted to make sure that the LMU group is with us. The thumbnail is very small, and they seem to be still involved in a discussion. So LMU, could you give us a smiley if you are with us again? LMU? Okay, great. Okay, Susan, or everyone, I think Susan just invited people to share their thoughts about what this graphic helped you to better understand and to see.
Okay, so for me especially, I think what helped the model was that to the distinction between the processes and modules that are there at the beginning and then and the process that are happening before I engage in a task, and then the other processes and tasks that more happen while I'm doing a task, and yeah, those, the difference between those two.
Marina, sorry, still no sound. You have to rely on the text chat. If you could type that in, sorry.
So Marina says, let me just read this aloud. Learning goals and epistemic beliefs are the broader context where a learning activity occurs. And that's kind of like the point just raised, that is, they exist prior to. Learning is an ongoing process that's being online shaped by self-regulation and metacognitive experiences. And then thinking about the thinking that is taking place and evaluating whether the quality of learning that is taking place meets the expected learning goals. If not, then learning tactics are reshaped. So that is the monitoring piece. Okay, next. So Raphael and Yita, Juana, Randy, can we hear some thoughts from you? And there's a large group at LMU, so anybody else have a thought about what they would like to contribute?
Well, I think the model is about self-regulation, where learners basically have the learning goal and what they think knowledge is all about, which is the epistemic beliefs. And then based on that, they use their cognitive strategies, their actions and operations, and there is some kind of learning outcome. So then they reflect, which is a meta experience, and the monitoring process in general, which leads to whether they judge themselves whether they know they have achieved their goals or was the strategy appropriate or not. And then based on the decision, they come back to the cognitive strategies. One of the questions I have is, when we look at the monitoring strategies and goals, the box in the center, it's kind of not connected to any of the others. Is there any way to work on the monitoring strategies themselves, not on just the cognitive strategies or the activities we perform to reach the learning goals, but also the way we monitor our strategies? So I think there has to be some kind of input to that box so that it improves over time, or we can work on its improvement itself. That's my initial thoughts. Thanks.
That's a really good question about, and noticing that it doesn't have any input into it is a really good observation. I'm not sure. I think that's an interesting question to put out there as one that needs to get addressed. How do we come to be able to improve our strategies and their ability to meet goals if there's no input into that box? Very good question. Very good insight from that diagram. Okay, somebody else?
Hello, I have two thoughts that come to my mind when I see this diagram, especially because of my research interest at the moment. And one of them is that when we have, it seems that the the learning outcome can be reached with or without the monitoring process, right? We do not have to go to the upper part of the diagram. We can just go in the lower one and have no metacognitive process. But this metacognitive process begins with the meta experience. And I wonder what is needed to jump from regular experience to a meta experience, in the sense of, if we are talking about environments where learning is not an explicit outcome. Well, it seems in the diagram that we do not need monitoring process for learning outcome. You can learn something and do not really monitor your learning process. That's what I got. But what I'm thinking about, if you are in a context in which there are learning possibilities, but there's no explicit will to learn or no explicit goal, like for example, if you are gardening or watching TV or talking to your friends or playing a game, that's my topic. If there is not a motivation for metacognition, how it can occur, or how it can occur maybe only beforehand or afterwards. The other idea that comes to my mind is how much this process, where the process of transfer of learning fits in the diagram. Is it something that is included somewhere in the metacognition itself, about thinking about how can I transfer this knowledge to a new context? That's something I was wondering. I think that's it. Thanks.
Okay, does anybody else want to contribute some thoughts on this diagram?
Yes, we wanted, or at least I wanted to contribute something else, because we had a discussion before the webinar about monitoring as something internal, and giving or receiving feedback as something external, which might be a possibility to learn self-monitoring. And when Engida asked his question, I thought this might be a point to discuss also how much feedback can serve as a learning opportunity for your metacognitive monitoring.
Well, I have a question that's maybe a bit too general at the moment, but Susan, you introduced the whole topic as being a consequence or things that happened after the behaviorist paradigm was left or was quitted, and then I was wondering if this is still we could say of this diagram, this is still everything is in what the behaviorists thought of being in the black box. So everything is in the black box. And I thought some aspects of situative cognition would also include some more aspects of the context of, well, let's say some stimuli again, and also some behavioral aspects. So this diagram seems to me still very much in the head. So there is no link to a box that is really outside the head.
I think that that's a really good observation. I don't think that the authors of this article have very much of a situated perspective, a situative perspective on this stuff. I do think that the points raised about feedback and just, you know, being unaware of metacognitive processes we could have an interesting discussion about where the other sits in this diagram, or not in this diagram, but how the other would fit into this conception. And right now it's not at all clear. This is I think pretty much individual in the head model, as you've pointed out. We could expand it. We could talk about cognitive strategies, actions, operations. There are also externalized physical actions and operations that are not necessarily excluded here, but they're not really included either. And if you put this whole thing in a social context, how that then interacts with what your goals and beliefs are and where you get input about how well your learning is going, I think hugely complicates the picture that's presented here. It certainly begins to suggest where the resources might be to address some of the questions that were raised by the LMU group. How much does feedback serve? Feedback from who? So a lot of the experiments that Griffin and Wiley and Keith Titi have done are all the individual, so very much an in-the-head model. But much of the work that you guys have been involved in collaborative learning, we know that you get feedback from others, and we know that others could potentially monitor your performance for you. And then does that get internalized? When does it get internalized? How does it get internalized? I think that's a whole set of questions that are totally not addressed by the model that we see in this figure. totally not addressed. I think they're really important questions because they get to this issue that Angita's observation that the monitoring strategies and goals, they are not connected to anything. Well, I think that's one place in which the impact of others interacting with others would potentially be input to that, where you learn what others do and you get feedback about the success of your efforts, which comes from others. So I think your question in combination with Angita's observation and the whole point about feedback and input into the system are really great questions. I don't have any answers particularly, but I think that's an important way in which monitoring that starts outside this particular system, how does that monitoring or metacognitive activities or observing other people's strategies, how that then and where that impacts the system, I think is a good set of questions because it could impact it at many places.
Marina, sorry to interrupt, but I guess I know what you would like to say. Maybe you wanted to ask, how would this diagram be transformed to describe co-regulation? Because that is what you typed into the chat, but you have still no audio. Sorry, Marina.
Marina, I know it's hard because we don't have your audio, but could you just say what you mean by co-regulation? While Marina's doing that, I want to get to this point about whether something that's externalized, could it be metacognitive? So I'm working with Cindy Greenleaf and a group from WestEd that have been working in classrooms for a long time. And one of the strategies, instructional strategies, that they use are called metacognitive conversations. These are not internal in the head conversations. These are conversations that teachers lead, that students lead about how they're understanding things, where understanding is happening, what's making something difficult, what's making something hard to understand, why was something easy to understand, how are we thinking about what we're reading, and how are we making sense of it, and how are we attempting to solve? What did we do when we ran into a difficulty in trying to understand something? Those are externalized conversations. They call them metacognitive conversations because they're conversations about the learning and thinking that you're doing. Can they be called metacognition? I think they can. But there's a difference between whether that metacognition or what aspects of those conversations get picked up by the individual and internalized. I think that's, if we go back to Vygotsky's notion that you learn from more knowledgeable others, and the Piagetian notion that you learn just from different perspectives being presented, even if they're, quote, not from more, quote, unquote, knowledgeable others, the value of multiple perspectives on how people think about things, as well as how they think about their thinking, I think can have a powerful impact on your own takeaways, your own knowledge about how your brain works. I mean, certainly we can all look at some of the neuroscience data that shows that there are different activation patterns in parts of the brain after you learn a particular thing. So if it's a spatial task, the parts of the brain that are really active in processing spatial information show a lot more activity, and potentially some new pathways get developed, stronger connections get developed among various neurons and synapses within the brain after you've had a powerful spatial learning experience. You can know that that's what happens. That's part of your knowledge about what is the impact of a learning experience. Now, you can add that to what you know. Now, there's some research that suggests that when you know that, you end up being motivated differently to participate and to work hard at a task, as opposed to if you don't understand that. So some work that, it's not Carol Dweck, one of her colleagues, Catherine Good and Carol Dweck did some really fascinating work on mathematics in high school students, where when they taught students about how the brain actually, the pathways and activation patterns actually change after you learn particular kinds of mathematics. Learning that about how the brain works, actually, students who learned that actually did better in math achievement than a group of students who had the same math curricula but didn't get exposed to that information about changes in the brain structure. That's pretty powerful data to suggest that, and Dweck connects it to this, her theory about beliefs about how, whether smarts, quote unquote, inherited and there's nothing you can do about it versus is a matter of putting effort into learning things. I'm blocking on the language she uses, but the point is that you can learn something like that, and then it becomes part of what you know about knowledge, knowledge acquisition, and its impact on yourself, on your brain. That then feeds into how you might perform in a particular task. So even though it starts out externally, it can become part of your knowledge base and internalized, and then impact how you behave. I'm sort of sharing attention between the chat box and what I'm saying, and sometimes it gets a little hard to organize that. So LMU says, can externalized activities be considered metacognitive? LMU says it could be used as a model for metacognitive activities. Exactly so. It's a learning opportunity. Marina says she thinks about it in situative terms, where the role of others. Okay, so I think you, Marina asks whether the focus should be on what gets externalized or what occurs within the group or on what gets internalized. So I think there's a couple different ways to answer that. If you want to know, for example, if you want to know about what the group learned, then you wouldn't necessarily make assumptions that any particular individual in the group had internalized it. You'd have to wait and you'd have to sort of assess that later. But I think it's possible to ask the question, well, why did a change in somebody's metacognitive activity occur? It could be a number of sources. If you know something about the group they participated in, you might want to hypothesize that it's because of the nature of that group focus, but you'd need to have, of course, data that supports that claim. What happened in the group? How do you trace what happened in the group to what the individual is doing at some point later in time? Frankie and others who've really studied group processes, I wondered if you have any comments about that.
So maybe just one comment or two. Well, what is often done in collaborative learning situations is that you bring people together, and often it's not even bringing more knowledgeable and less knowledgeable learners together, but having more or less peers on the same level of prior knowledge. But then give, for example, in computer-supported collaborative learning, give some scaffolding, some additional information into that group that helps the group to perform on a level that is beyond what they would be able to without that support. So And then also at some point, some of the research that was that has been done on scripting has also been looking at how people, if they have the freedom, or if if you ask them to develop their own script, so their own so to say scaffolds, and to switch off some scaffolds and keep on going with other scaffolds, how they develop the regulation of the group process, but also at the same time develop the regulation on the individual process of some cases that they have been discussing.
Yeah, I think that that's really some good insights into the way that works. I think the notion that the other could be the computer providing some support and how the group takes that up is of interest. Daniel from the LMU group said, excuse me, it's high pollen season here in Chicago, and I'm experiencing some allergy attacks, so forgive me. I like the notion that group awareness tools might be considered a group version of monitoring. So these are tools like who talks a lot, and just sort of reflecting back, participation is one set of group awareness tools that I know about. I don't know, there are probably others that I don't know about. But I think you have to have an explicit opportunity or time, or make that part of the group's work, to actually look at their process and make some comments on it. I think I want to leave this part of the conversation and hear about this little mini assignment for today's seminar. I was hoping you might actually go and check out how people have talked about metacognition, monitoring, etc., in the context of the disciplines you're studying. So for those of you interested in developmental work, there's a, in the biology domain especially, there's a lot of stuff about theory of mind and how young kids think about what their theories are of how their bodies work, for example. I don't know if you've come across that. So what, let's do this. Let's take, let's have the LMU group go offline by muting their microphone. And I don't know, there are several different interests there. If you maybe want to cluster into small groups around the preschool emphasis, the science reasoning emphasis, and the math and assessment. So that's, there's math, there's about four different groups represented among you as far as I can tell. You maybe want to break up into four groups, and then each group might report out on where you think either aspect of metacognition might come into play. And then those of us who are single, that is Marina, Angita, Raphael, Juana, Randy, I'm not sure who's at iTeach, and Frank, we could sort of stay online and exchange ideas, just talk through some of what we came up with in our areas, and then come back together in maybe, well, it's 11:20, so maybe in about 5 or 6 minutes. Sound okay? Okay, so let's start with folks who have sound, have audio. Raphael, what did you come up with for your interest area?
Sorry, I'm not sure if I got the proposal correctly, but I thought it was about the thing that I'm studying specifically, and not about what my field of study. I mean, what, can you just clarify this? Or
you're talking about where does metacognition fit into video games, right? So what do you suspect, or what is there any literature on how people monitor in when they're game playing, or how they think about or start to form ideas about how the game works?
All right. I don't really know much work talking specifically about metacognition and games, and that's one of the reasons why I'm kind of investigating this area. Normally, because I'm thinking about what people learn when they play commercial games for fun and not talking about educational games. And in this case, there are several claims about what people can learn through digital games that they just play for fun. And I do think that in this area, most people always talk about incidental learning. It means that, well, of course, because if players are trying to have fun in their leisure time, they don't have learning goals, and therefore, if anything that they learn is incidental, is not intentional. And that's one of the reasons why I'm thinking about, well, what would happen if players begin to be more aware of what they could learn? But then when we think about the process of monitoring process when you play video games, I'm not sure if it fits in metacognition, because it seems to me that metacognition is mostly something that happens while you are in the learning activity, whereas if you begin to have lots of monitoring processes during gameplay while you play a game, it basically spoils the game, because people don't want to do that in their leisure time. Then I do believe that this process of metacognition would have to be in before or after playing the game, for example. I'm not sure if it fits in the idea of metacognition if you just have a more mindful choice of what you play, with whom you play, and how you play, but not necessarily being aware of these things during the process of playing. So that's something that I don't know about anyone that's talking about this, because it seems to be all about learning incidentally. You're learning, or self-learning, you can say. And then it kind of worries me that sometimes we have more claims in this area than actually good evidence that people are learning in wider sense, or that just a few specific cases of people can learn through games, but it's not what's really happening with the huge mass of people that are actually playing. So that are some of the thoughts in my area specific about game-based learning, I would say.
I think that's very interesting. I pulled out two nuggets from what you were saying, having to do with one question really being, is incidental learning compatible with monitoring your performance? And I also was thinking about the fact that in my own sort of, even if it is leisure play gameplay, I do think about strategies that I might be using and whether the strategy I'm using is the most effective for getting further in the game. So I think you can think about your gameplay, and maybe even while you're in the midst of playing the game, depending on the kind of immediacy of the time demands and how quickly you have to make decisions. But even if you're in a sort of game, I think anyway, even if you're in a game context where you have to be reacting more rather than thinking more in between moves, I still think that afterwards you can think about whether, to the degree that you can recapture what you did, you could think about whether or not you thought it was effective.
Yeah, just to complete this idea, I'm pretty sure that people learn a lot playing games, but the problem is that they basically learn how to play the game better. As I said, they improve their strategies to play the game. But if you're talking about, for example, when you learn through your mistakes, right, if you can analyze your mistake and try again and learn with your mistake, that's why I asked about transfer before, then can you play the game, learn through your mistakes, and try to understand how you learned about learning about mistakes, and then transfer this to a different context, it's not in the game, So in this context, gets a little more. I think it is very demanding of the player to have this kind of monitoring that goes beyond the gaming context.
I found that discussion very interesting, and I wonder if there is research maybe in the area of metacognition outside the video game research that deals with metacognition under time pressure or in a synchronous or kind of highly interactive situation. I think that might be quite similar to the game context.
Well, what I found so far, we have research about both external aids or scaffolding processes to game-based learning, but then we're always talking about educational games in educational contexts. And what I'm really interested is to think about the other side, about all these claims that people do that, about what people are learning through games when they are in their leisure time with no intention to learn. And in this case, I don't think we have. It's very different because we don't really have intention to learn. It's not something explicit for you. But in theory, some learning that is transferable occurs. That's the kind of dilemma that I'm facing, really. I'm not sure about metacognition under time pressure in games. Yeah, I think that's the question. Can you learn about how you learned in the game? Or can you use these learning strategies that you used in the game in a non-game environment?
I think those are really interesting questions. And I think this notion about research on metacognition under time pressure is also a really interesting question. So, LMU, are you back online? If you now, okay, cool. All right, so one of the questions that Raphael brought in was in his interest with video gaming is that's often talked about as incidental learning. Is it compatible with monitoring? Can you learn about how you learned in the game and then transfer that to some other situation when in fact you're sort of in a real like kind of leisure mode? I think those are really good questions. I tried to capture some of those in the chat box so that you could see them. Frank, can you just type in the chat box, when do we end? Is it 11:45 or what time? I'm going to wait to see because then I want to see what else people have. Juana wants to speak next, so let's go to Juana and then Frank. 10 minutes to go. Okay, so Juana, why don't you tell us what?
Well, usually I speak more, but today I am not speaking very much because I have too many questions. All the questions are coming to my head, which is very interesting. My main question is, it's also related to what Frank was saying. When I read papers about and research about metacognition and about even other topics in learning sciences, I think it's a big reductionism because I am working in natural environment, so to say. And I'm interested not only about how students learn in the classroom, but especially I'm interested about how professionals learn, why teachers, for instance, stop learning in a moment. They can't learn from their mistakes. They can't, well, and politicians and everybody. So for me, it's like too narrow. It's I see these diagrams and I don't see the people there because contexts are much more complex. So I don't know how can, well, the situative or the situated cognition, but can help a bit. But I think still much more complex real situations. And then, well, this is a general comment, and also at the beginning when you were explaining about the history of the cognitive sciences and the learning sciences, I wonder why they at the beginning they had a very interesting agenda, because they were saying, all right, we are going to put together psychology, computing, sociology, anthropology. But at the end, for instance, sociology, anthropology, the more contextual and the more, so to say, complex and soft and difficult sciences left the agenda. Why is that? Why we are still so much pulled by, I think we are very much influenced by behaviorism anyway. I mean, we have not done the jump that is trying to cope with the complexity of what learning really means. Well, I don't know. There are big questions, I know, but this is what worries me anyway.
So I actually think that if you look at the work on the design experiment work, I think that is actually trying to take a contextualized perspective and deal with the complexity of real learning situations. I think you still have a heavy emphasis from other traditions in work on learning, for sure. And some of those are still very much psychology or cognitive psychology orientations. But if you look at for example, I'm also doing some work on the public understanding of science, which is very much getting into trying to understand about how communication sciences understands persuasion and attitude formation and belief structures, which is outside the realm of psychology, and it does get much more complicated. So I think that depends on what you're kind of, I do think we have, so the whole situated cognition perspective is where I think Jim Greeno brought that into sort of the conversation through his interactions with Jean Lave, who's an anthropologist. And I think looking at systems and complex systems, the whole sort of activity theory notions and chat theory also takes this sort of, tries to tackle the complexity. I think what you may be reacting to is some of our journals require certain forms of analysis of data that suggest that some of this complexity needs to just be stripped away. And I think you need to find the appropriate journal to help you get your work out. But I do think that there is in learning sciences a large number of people who are concerned with understanding this, what Anne Brown talked about when she first wrote the design experiments paper back in 1992. It was the buzzing, gloomy confusion, or the bubble, buzzing, booming complexity that is a classroom. And I still think many of us are trying to understand that. And I think that this whole notion of externalizing our conversations about how we're learning takes into account the potential for really learning a lot of important things from talking with others about their learning. And we're beginning to see in the work we've incorporated that into, and Cindy Greenleaf has seen in a lot of her prior work, this has a tremendous impact, especially on kids who tend to pull back, feel like they can't contribute. When these conversations get part of the discourse in the classroom and are accepted as such and valued, talking about what you don't understand becomes more important than talking about what you do understand and how others understand that. And that makes it a lot more complicated than this diagram does, for sure. So let's hear a bit from the LMU group, because we only have a few minutes. And Gita, I didn't mean to cut you out, but there's like 12 people at LMU, none of whom have said anything about their what they found out. So I'd like to get them in and come back if you want to add additional.
So from the mathematics group, we thought that especially within the proving process, when proving some theorem statement or something else, students or pupils need lots of metacognition, because, well, even at the start when they have to think about what do they want to prove, how could they approach this, what kind of problem-solving strategies could they use, they have to use metacognition, monitor, then how are they, well, how are they doing, is the proof getting better and better, are they going to the aim status or not, and at the end they have of course to reflect about this and monitor, was everything I did correct, was all deductive reasoning. And we've also been talking about the mathematical communities or peers or tutors, the docent, looking at those proofs and giving feedback as an external kind of monitoring. The other groups?
So the assessment group saw that one connection was that there's actually a lot of difference out there when it comes to the assessment of scientific reasoning, when it comes to what people can do and what people can't do. And one explanation for those huge differences could be that some tasks are more prone to activate the metacognition and then and thus reducing the error rate. And besides that, we talked a little bit about more the peer assessment feedback system. So what we talked a little bit before, how maybe assessment by others first can kind of function like an external metacognitive strategy, and then hopefully become in the process more an internally used metacognitive strategy. And that way an assessment by maybe a student that is in a higher year could help you to improve your metacognitive skills.
Okay. In the preschool group, actually, we discussed about what kind of cognitive constructs can be related to metacognition. And actually, we kind of think that theory of mind development can be related to development of metacognition and can be a precursor of development of metacognition, since in the theory of mind development, the child should need the knowledge of self and the knowledge of others, then they then can think about these knowledge processes. So it seems the development of theory of mind is a precursor of it. And for my research, I was thinking about in the scientific reasoning area, you know, one of the things that preschool children are not able to do very well is reflecting on their processes. So, and this is a really, this prevents them to go further on their knowledge. So, so in our tasks, in my task, for instance, I was thinking, whether this reflection on the task is also a similar thing to metacognition, metacognitive ability.
Okay, that's very interesting in ways in which metacognition comes in a number of different domains. I think that Henry Wellman and others have really written a lot about theory of mind being the precursor. And I think they were talking a lot about memory, but I think there's other work on theory of mind in biology that's been done much more recently that would be useful to look at. Does anybody want to offer any other thoughts about metacognition? We need to be wrapping up. Frank has just indicated he wants to talk. He probably has something important about our time left, so I'm going to.
No, actually, Well, yes, it has to do with the time. So, Susan, I asked that because you are one of the co-editors of the whole series. We agreed to have two questions that we ask all our presenters at the end. And let me also briefly ask these two questions now. So one question is, what would be your recommendation for PhD students if they are interested in doing or including aspects of metacognition in their research? Well, it had been addressed to some extent already. And the other question, I think even more important right now, and I have to admit I was not so aware how important that is. What would you say, why is metacognition so important and so relevant for the learning sciences? This is, of course, also a definitional question with respect to the learning sciences. So why is metacognition important for the learning sciences? Why do learning scientists need to consider metacognition, although it seems to still be, well, a quite cognitive concept as we found it in the representation earlier. So why is it important for the learning sciences?
So I could respond by saying, why wouldn't it be important? But that's not going to help very much. I guess for me, is that if it's part of how individuals learn and get better at things, and there are claims that it's how they transfer to new situations because they have awareness of things that worked in prior situations and the things they can bring to new situations to tackle new tasks. That if an individual, you know, understanding how an individual comes to a situation, whether it's learning with others or learning by themselves, I think it's important to understand that that's part of the equipment that comes, just like the way they think about things, or the knowledge they have knowledge of content, they have knowledge of how their mind works. All that is part of the package that they bring to a particular situation that's then going to interact with new material or with other people or with both. So part of the complexity is understanding how we understand how we learn. If there are some interesting examples of case study situations that have been brought to people's attention. I'm thinking of one in particular that Randy Engel talks about, where someone who really has the wrong answer gets the floor and keeps the floor and basically ends up dominating the conversation and what people walk away with from that conversation, believing about the phenomenon. This is a paper she published recently, actually, in JLS. And so, I mean, part of it is to understand, well, the dynamics of how that could happen. And part of it might have to do with this very important notion of what people understand about others' learning and their own learning. So part of metacognition is knowing that something doesn't make sense. And if someone is saying something that doesn't make sense or for which there's not good data, then that ought to make you question it. And if you question it, you may unearth a lot of other things and a lot of other knowledge gaps that might make you more likely to engage in argumentation with this person that would ultimately result in everybody learning more effectively. So I think that we may not necessarily think about it as metacognition, but that those kinds of interactions occur in natural learning situations all the time, as well as in studied ones, and that they're important to understand the dynamics of how groups progress and don't progress. That's my take on it.
Okay, so I would like to thank you. I have the sun shining right into my face here. Hope you can still see me. I want to thank Susan a lot for this webinar. I think Susan also has another slide for the wrap up. Not sure if you are intending to go a little bit further into that, Susan, or if we can just close that session. Maybe everyone could say a couple of words and then Susan would have the final word then at the end. So thanks a lot. That was very, as people are writing in the chat, a very insightful and interesting discussion, online learning experience, highly interactive. Thanks a lot, Susan, and also, of course, all the participants.
So thank you very much from Munich. We had some great discussion here, and we even had problems coming back to the webinar because we were too we were too deeply in the discussion. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you to everybody for your participation. I thought we also had some interesting conversations about how, especially about how you take the in the head model and think about it in the complexity of natural learning situations. I really appreciated that, and other points that people raised as well. The wrap-up slide is just some bottom lines that you could look at on your own, but I was just trying to capture why I think to regulate our learning processes, to know when they're going well or not, we absolutely have to have a metacognitive function going on, both about knowing what we do to learn, as well as how it's going. I think they're critical for us to effectively use our learning experiences. And I'll quit there. Say thanks to all of you for your participation, and Frank for your moderation, and see you all next time.